international loan finance. We're looking at the nature of the syndicated lending market. We need to understand the structure of the deal, all of the parties that are concerned, and then build up our understanding of the rights and obligations of each of the parties concerned. What are we looking at? This is a typical standard international lending agreement, international lending structure. Who are the parties? We've got the lenders, we've got the borrowers. It's a term loan which is for a fixed term. The lenders will be the largest banks in the world, the commercial banks, who will come together in groups or syndicates to make the funds available on a participation basis, on a club group basis. The borrowers will either be the governments of the world or the largest companies in the world, or maybe smaller and medium-sized companies in the world. They all use this market because this is where they can obtain the largest volume of funds at the cheapest rates in the world. That's why these markets are so important, and it's also why they're all based in London. Because the largest companies in the world and all the governments in the world can borrow the most amount at the least expensive cost, which means that they can cover all of their own domestic costs, facilities, infrastructure, projects, whatever else they're working on at any particular time at the domestic level. Now, it's a term loan, which means it's for a specific duration. Because we're borrowing large amounts of money, it's usually an extended term, typically 20 years. It might be 10, but that's quite a short one. 10 years up to 30, if it's an international financial organisation, even up to 50 years. Standard size, let's say, 20 years. What will happen is this. You will then have the borrower. If it's a corporate borrower, there will usually always be a large number of other companies in the group also borrowing. So you'll have the parent bank, and then possibly, to create a standard example, let's say up to 9 subsidiaries. So there'll be one parent bank with 9 subsidiaries. They're all borrowing, so it's 10 borrowers. There will be a large number of lenders, because we've explained it's syndication, so we can spread the risk. Let's assume that there's 10 members of the syndicate, so there's 10 banks in the syndicate. So we have 10 borrowers and we have 10 banks. That's the basic structure of a typical deal that we're going to be looking at. Just by way of introductory point, if there's one loan agreement, but there's 10 borrowers and there's 10 lenders, how many loans?
One
or 100? Strictly speaking, it's 100. Because each of the banks is lending on a several basis, and each of the borrowers will be drawing down separately under the facility with separate drawdown terms. So strictly speaking, it's 10 times 10, it's 100. I'll go over this in a bit more detail. It's actually on the slide, and I deal with it further. You'll actually see here. We won't do this just now, we'll come back to this. There's basically 100 loans. But what we will see is this. There's actually two facilities in the standard document. There's a fixed term and there's also a revolver, which is like a credit line you draw down, repay. More like an overdraft. Draw down, repay. So there's a facility A is a term loan. There's a facility B is a revolver. So there's two facilities. So if there's 10 borrowers, 10 banks and two facilities, there's 200 minimum. But then there'll be a drawdown period. I'll do this quickly and then we'll come back and do it again. There will then be a drawdown period, maybe 2 years. And you can draw down every month over 2 years, so that's 24. So it's 24 times 200, we're already up to 1,200 or even 2,400. That's for the A facility alone. For the B facility, because it's a revolver, we may allow that to operate for the first 2 years, or we may allow it to operate for 20 years. If it's 20 years, again, it's then another 12 times 20, so we actually get up to 24,000. And then ultimately, the total number of loans under this facility may be 26,400. Legally, they're all separate, because the liabilities are all several, but they're all governed by one standard document, one single loan agreement. That's how powerful private law can be. There is a slight qualification, which again I'll come back to later. Strictly speaking, when the borrowers draw down, they submit a single drawdown request. We call it a utilisation request. And that goes to the agent bank, And the agent bank then instructs the banks that the funds are being requested. They may be payable, for example, the following Friday. So the banks will then obtain the money to make that available. Strictly speaking, there is a single utilisation or drawdown instrument or request. So it's not 100, it's not 10 times 10, it's 10 times 1. But strictly speaking, legally, because all of these loans are actually several, although it's a single request, and there's 10 banks, because they're all several, strictly speaking, legally, it's still 100. And then 100 times, as we've already multiplied it through, we can get up to 26,000. I'll come back and go over that in further detail. Now, the key point is this. Where do the banks obtain the funds to make available under the facility? So let's assume again there's a 100 million facility, there's 10 borrowers and there's 10 banks. Do the banks have to look at their deposit base? Do they have to have these funds in their bank account before they can lend it on to the borrowers? Answer, no. Because it's the euro dollar markets, the banks don't actually have this money. They never have this money. All that happens is they will go in to the interbank market, the euro dollar markets, and they draw down enough funds as required when it's necessary, when it's needed. So one borrower will say, I want to draw down 1 million or 10 million or whatever. That's notified to the agent bank, which will administer the facility. The agent bank notifies each of the banks in the syndicate, we need your share, let's say it's 10 million, so that's 1 million each, by next Friday. What will then happen is that bank, each of the separate banks goes into the market separately, draws down the funds, makes it available the following Friday. That's how these markets work. That's how these markets operate. And that's how they've been doing this for the last 40, 50, 60 years. And that's how the largest governments in the world fund all of their expenditure that they can't cover through immediate direct taxation in their home jurisdictions. That's why these markets are so important. So we have the lenders, the borrowers. It's a term loan, although strictly speaking, it's two facilities. There's a term facility, 20, 30, 40 years, and then there's a revolver, and then the terms will specify, is the revolver going to last for the full 20 years or a portion of that? There's three. Under the standard documentation that we were looking at, there will always be two. It doesn't have to be legally, they can be separate, it can only be one or the other, but in practice we tend to mix the two together. With regards to the facilities themselves, these term loans are very important. They're actually the basis for a whole series of other financial transactions in the international financial marketplace. And I've summarised those top right. So, loan facilities, it's the basis for the euro dollar markets. By participated there, I mean it's syndicated, it's the club loans. Also, any other multi-purpose facilities, we can build this into other more complex funding arrangements, which will include a range of other instruments we've already talked about, such as bankers' acceptances, certificates of deposit, maybe a credit line, probably what we call a medium term note program, which is a short bond, but we'll come on and look at that. But you could also have a term loan in this facility as well. So a MOFA or a MOF multi option facility or a MOFA multi option funding facility is a combination of other instruments pooled together so that we give the maximum possible flexibility to the borrowing company. We've also got other term and revolving facilities, either for fixed terms or revolvers, which we sometimes call an RCF. We have credit lines, which are short revolving facilities. We can have title finance, where we're buying land, or we're buying ships, or we're buying aircraft. All of this is based on the standard term loans that we're looking at this stage. We also have project finance. We may be building oil refineries, nuclear reactors, power stations. We may be building railway systems, railway stations. We may be building hotels, desalination plants, almost anything you can imagine. Almost every form of large infrastructure in the world is done through project finance. What does that mean? The project is going to produce an income stream. So the company or the government or the agency building whatever it is doesn't have to have any money. It doesn't have to have any assets. All that it has to have is an income stream coming from the project. Because all we will then do is this. We calculate what it's going to cost to build the project, to fund it, the interest rate, as well as other elements, for example, decommissioning. We calculate that in aggregate, and then we divide that by the future income stream. And so long as the future income stream can cover the costs, we can build almost anything, anywhere. Project finance is very valuable, very important facility for that reason. Property finance, real estate finance, as well as acquisition finance, buying companies. You get a lot of different types of increasingly complex structures, including, for example, mezzanine deals, where we're mixing debt with lending, and with the lending being convertible into debt as well, usually through what's called a warrant, when you attach an entitlement to buy something else at a fixed price in addition to what you've already got, as well as that could actually support a loan. So you've got a loan which has also got a warrant allowing you to buy notes or other bonds. So there's all sorts of flexibility, there's all sorts of different types of options we can build into these transactions. We'll then also get securitization. We'll look at this in further detail. In the banking markets, we basically enter into loans, credit instruments of various forms. They're either going to be term or fixed, or they're going to be floating. What we can do is this. We can convert those into securities through securitization structures, and we'll come back and look at that in further detail. Essentially, what you will do is this. If the credit elements are of the same classification legally, governed by the same terms and conditions, we pull them together. So we don't look at one mortgage, or one student loan, or one car loan. We look at 5,000 of them, or 10,000. And so long as they're all governed by the same terms, we can pool them together. They then become a single asset class. And what we're going to do is this. We're going to sell that asset class to a new special purpose vehicle, an SPV, which is a shell company and a shelf company. A shelf company means we buy it off a shelf. A shell company means it can do anything we want it to do. And it will be set up usually in an offshore financial centre. To avoid tax, no, but to avoid creating additional tax charges during the deal. We don't mind paying tax when deals are done at the end, but what we don't want to do is to trigger all sorts of unnecessary tax charges while we're setting something up or funding something or building something. So that's why we very often use offshore financial centres. It's not to avoid tax, it's simply to postpone the tax till the end when the tax should properly be due, paid and calculated. So very often we'll do special purpose vehicles which will purchase these assets. The special purpose vehicle will then issue new bonds or notes into the market, including short notes, or if it's less than 1 year, it's commercial paper. So it can issue all of these new securities into the market to buy this asset pool. So what we've effectively done is we've converted an asset pool into a security pool. That's securitization. We'll come back and look at that in further detail. Subordinated debt simply means that we create lending structures where there's a number of parties and we determine the liability of each of the parties. So we postpone some parties behind other parties. We create priorities. We create payment hierarchies so that certain groups have to be paid before other groups. Simple as that, subordinated debt. So there's all of these large number of different types of facilities, and all of these are based on one thing, a term loan. That's why we need to understand the core legal nature, rights and obligations of a term facility. What I've tried to do is this. There's five key elements within this, which we'll see in the documentation we're coming to look at. There's the principal, that's the amount. What are we borrowing? For example, 100 million. There's the term or the duration, for example, 20 years, 10 years or 30 years. The drawdown, is it going to be drawn down all at once, or will it be over a period, or will it be in tranches? For these large complex facilities, especially when we've got more than one borrower, possibly a large group of borrowers, very rarely will it be drawn down on day one. So you enter into the loan agreement from the first of next month. Almost never will the borrowers draw all down immediately, because that's not what the purpose is. Some borrowers will need certain funds at different times and different amounts. So you will have a drawdown period. So very often what we'll do is we'll specify maybe 1 year or 2 years at the beginning of the 20 years to allow the borrowers to draw down. So there'll be a drawdown period. They can draw down any amount they like, usually in any currency they like. All they have to do is specify that in the drawdown request or the utilisation request. Interest. Usually interest on the early loans was always fixed. The early euro loan markets, it was always fixed. But what would then happen is, because of the massive currency instability that arose from the beginning of the 1970s after the collapse of the Bretton Woods system, we moved on to floating currencies. Because we have floating currencies, most facilities now will have a floating rate rather than a fixed rate. Early long-term instruments were usually fixed. Now people will increasingly rely on floating rates. Again, what it simply means is this. If the bank is going to borrow the funds in the interbank market, what is it going to charge the borrower? The borrower will basically be made liable to repay what we call the LIBOR rate. We now just talk about it in terms of the interbank rate or the reference rate. It used to be the London Interbank Offered Rate, LIBOR. LIBOR was the main rate at which all of these facilities were calculated. And that's essentially the cost of one bank borrowing the specific amount of money in the markets overnight on an unsecured basis. As we explained before, the banks don't actually have this money. All that will happen is they will be notified that the funds are due a certain amount the following Friday. So the bank will then go into the markets and draw down the necessary amount of funds for the relevant period. The interest will be calculated on the basis of it was LIBOR. That's the cost of the bank's funding. So what then happens is this, and we'll see this in the documentation. What the borrower is going to pay is LIBOR plus the bank's margin. And the margin is the profit. So the bank's profit, for example, is 200 basis points. That's 2%. Or 250. 2.5 basis points. High risk, it might be 3, might be 4, might be 5, might be more. 500 basis points, right? So what's the borrower going to pay? The borrower is going to pay the LIBOR rate plus the margin. So if the LIBOR rate, let's say today is, today actually it's 2.3%, it's 230 basis points. So if the margin is 200 and the LIBOR rate today is 230, the borrower is going to pay 430. Simple as that. What we'll also see is there's additional cost that we'll add on top of that, and we'll look at that and we'll see how all of that's provided for in the documentation. But the key mechanism in this market is that the borrower will always pay the bank's cost of funds on the interbank market, whether it's fixed or floating, and on top of that, a margin. And the margin is the bank's profit. I'll come back to LIBOR rates later just to explain. Scandals had occurred in this area mainly after the global financial crisis. What actually happened was Barclays Bank in London admitted to having submitted some slightly incorrect rates during the global financial crisis. It wasn't done to make a profit. It wasn't done to generate funds in any way. It was actually intended to avoid investors being concerned that Barclays may be in difficulty, which could have caused a collapse in its share price and then triggered a bank run. It was actually done for a legitimate reason. The only problem was it hadn't discussed that with the Bank of England first or any of the regulators first. This created very substantial concerns, very substantial criticism of the way the LIBOR system was working. For that reason, we have almost effectively abandoned LIBOR as such, but we've now moved on to a new rate in London, which is called SONIA, the sterling overnight rate, sterling overnight interest rate. SONIA. So we're now moving from LIBOR to SONIA. Other financial centres have their own local interbank rate as well. So, for example, in Singapore you have SIBOR, in Tokyo you have TIBOR, in the European Union it was EONIA, E-O-N-I-A, EONIA, now it's ESTER, all the banks in Europe are moving on to ESTR, which is set by the European Central Bank, ESTER. It's the European exchange rate. All of the main financial centres then have their own rates, which everybody now refers to. Formerly, it was all done through the London rate, the LIBOR, but it's now broken up, so depending upon where the facility is managed, you'll use the local offered rate. In London, it's now SONIA. So SONIA's replacing LIBOR. The only problem is there's a huge number of facilities. There's something like 100 to 200, maybe 200 plus trillion dollars of facilities still governed by the old LIBOR rates. So what happens when LIBOR is no longer available? LIBOR was actually ended from the 1st of January 2022. What's actually happened is because a lot of the banks hadn't taken the necessary changes, made the necessary documentation revisions to allow for this, to provide for this, to create a substitute rate, the Bank of England's actually created what it's calling synthetics. So we actually have some synthetic sterling rates, dollar rates, and I think Japanese yen rates. So there's some synthetics, artificial, extended LIBOR rates which will apply for a limited period into 2023. But what the Bank of England and the regulators are trying to do is move all the banks from LIBOR to SONIA. With all other core financial centres, they've now got their own localised, I keep calling it domestic, it's not domestic because it's an interbank thing, local versions, equivalent systems to what was LIBOR and now SONIA. We've then got repayment. We need to specify the terms of repayment in the documentation as well. And this creates the same point as with the drawdown. Are we going to repay everything at once, or are we going to repay over a schedule, which we can sometimes refer to as amortization, or what are the terms of repayment going to be? It might be a bullet repayment, which means you draw down 100 million and then you repay 100 million at the very end on the last day of the facility. In practice, it's more likely to be a more complex form of repayment. But then we have to look at various other issues that may arise in connection with that, and we'll see how all of that's done in the documentation. So the five key sets of provisions we're looking at are the principal, which is the amount, the term is the duration, the drawdown, the interest, and the repayment, and then the other associated obligations, which are set out in the facility, and we'll come on to look at all of that in further detail. So what we've got is this. In terms of the core documentation, we then have three key things. In a loan, we'll look at bond deals subsequently later. In a loan deal, we need a mandate letter. The lead bank will approach the borrower, or the borrower will approach the lead bank. In practice, the lead banks, the largest commercial banks and investment banks, are always approaching the main governments in the world and the largest borrowers in the world. All the time. All the time. Do you want any facilities? Can we assist you? Please let's have lunch. Please let's have a breakfast meeting. So usually what's happening is all of the largest banks in the world are always offering funding and services to the all the governments in the world and all the borrowers in the world, the corporate borrowers in these markets. So it's not usually the fact that the borrower says, we need some funds, let's go and find a bank to help us. In practice, we're usually being inundated with offers for assistance almost on a continuous basis. What we have to do is this. You initially take a mandate letter, which is the permission for the lead bank to proceed with the deal. We've already mentioned there will be a lead or managing bank who's going to set up the facility. It's the one that's going to create the syndicate. It's going to prepare the documentation. It's going to carry out key negotiations. It's going to draft the core documents. It's going to put the syndicate together. It's going to appoint what we call the agent bank. And then it's going to make sure everything's set up and running. Two key banks then are the lead bank or the managing bank, which sets the facility up, and then the agent bank, which administers the funding after the documentation is entered into, executed, and all of the funding is made available. So we have a lead bank or managing bank, and we have an agent bank. In practice, they're completely different. The lead bank will be an aggressive alpha institution, for example, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, just to pick some of the biggest securities houses on Wall Street. Or it might be Royal Bank of Scotland, it might be Deutsche Bank, it might be UBS. They're coming into the market, they're pushy, they're aggressive, they want to raise the funds, they want to assist the company or the government, but they want to then set the facility up, they want to take a large fee, possibly 0.5% of 100 million, that's the fee, and then they want to go on to the next deal. The Asian bank is then usually not even the core head office of a major commercial bank. Very often it's like a subsidiary or it's a kind of regional or branch of the bank because it's only carrying administrative functions. It's a much less sort of glorious, exciting, important, significant function. It's more simply an accounting administrative role, so they get paid much less for that. So you've got these two banks, the lead bank, the managing bank, and the agent bank. Do not confuse them. The lead bank, the managing bank, is going to receive a very large sum of money for this, usually a percentage of the total amount. The agent bank is going to get a small administrative fee just for dealing with the facility for the next 10, 20 years, for whatever the duration is. The fee payments are completely different. We'll also come on and talk about fees later. What's also going to happen is there's a third fee, and that's what we call the participation fee or the commitment fee. That goes to the syndicate banks. Each of the syndicate banks receives a small payment just for making the funds available. When the funds are drawn down, the borrower will pay the SONIA rate, what was the LIBOR, let's call it the IBOR, the interbank offered rate, IBOR, so it's not LIBOR, but IBOR. So generally all financial centres will have an IBOR, as we've said already. So the bank's going to pay IBOR plus the margin once the funds are drawn down. But before the funds are drawn down, the bank's already had to take steps to make sure that those funds are available so it can already charge. Even though it's not borrowing anything on the interbank markets, it can still charge. And it gets a small fee for that, usually 0.75%. We call that the commitment or the syndication fee. Right?
Who gives them this?
The borrower's going to pay everything. The borrower pays all of the costs. And what we'll do is this. When we look at the term loan agreement, I'll show you all the clauses and we'll connect them all together to see all the different types of payments. There's, for example, withholding taxes, there's other tax charges, there's indemnities, there's other legal costs or other change of documentation costs. There's all sorts of things which can arise, and I'll show you all the different clauses and we'll see how all of this works in practice. So, the first key document is the mandate letter. We need to get a mandate legally to set the syndicate up. That's the lead bank or the managing bank approaching the borrower to get permission to set up this facility. We then have what we call a term sheet. This used to be by way of fax, now it's all done electronically. The term sheet outlines the key financial terms. In practice now, so that would have been principal term, drawdown, interest and repayment, drawdown and repayment. In practice, what happens effectively now is that the term sheets, because they're prepared by lawyers, are effectively mini loan agreements. It's the same index as the loan agreement. It's effectively a mini loan document. All that happens is you have the key clauses, the key headings down the left-hand side, and then you have in boxes all the key clauses. And all that simply happens is the banker running the deal will go through this, check it out, we'll do this, we'll do that, accept that, change this, change that. So the term sheet becomes a mini summary set of all of the terms and conditions, which will be in the final loan agreement. So loan agreement is document number 4. Document number 3 is what we call an information memorandum. The information memorandum is the effect, the same equivalent to what we call a prospectus in a bond deal or a security issuance. The information memorandum provides all of the necessary details, background information to the borrower, what the funds are being borrowed for and how they'll be repaid. It's a summary statement of the financial condition and business operations of the borrower and the borrower's group. It's the same as a prospectus in a securities or a bond deal. We call this the information memorandum. The borrowers will prepare this, usually through their accountants, with the assistance of the lead bank. The lead bank can't do that himself or herself. has to be done by the borrowers.
The lead banks are not commercial banks.
The lead banks can be commercial banks or investment banks.
Or either of them, right?
We will then have the loan document. The loan document records all of the terms which have been set out in the term sheet in accordance with the instructions provided for in the mandate letter. The actual issue procedure I've summarised on the left-hand side. This is also provided for in the core documentation and in the chapter that I've given you. There will be the approach, that's the mandate letter. You have a fee letter, fee quotes that you'll have to provide up front so that the borrower knows what all the costs will be. You award the mandate, the lead bank will then solicit interest with other banks in the City of London to say, do you want to basically become a part of this syndicate? It will then instruct the solicitors to prepare the draft documentation while it's also working on the other documentation, including specifically the information memorandum with the borrowers, so we'll prepare all of the documentation. All of the documentation is then circulated around all of the other members of the syndicate. We'll finalise the terms, and then we will collect what we call the conditions precedent document, and we'll come on and look at all the obligations in more detail later. And then when we have everything in place, we'll have a signing, and then we have a closing. From that date, the borrowers can then draw down under the facility. They may want to draw down immediately, but usually we just have everything in place on the closing, and then that allows the borrowers at any time thereafter simply to give notice to the agent bank that they want to draw down. Or each of the members of the group, for example, we had one parent bank with 8-9 subsidiaries, each of them can submit the drawdown request to the agent bank at any time after the signing and after the closing. Syndication principles. The key point is this. We have a group of banks lending, but on what basis legally are they making these funds available? Is the liability joint and several, or is it several? In practice, it is several. So all of the banks are lending independently and separately. And we will see there's a number of standard clauses that we include in the documentation to make this clear. That it's several, it's not joint and several, that the rights are divided, they're separate, basically so that each of the banks can sue separately if they want. But we'll see there's other controls on that afterwards. But what we have to then do is this. We have to determine the nature of the relationship in law between the syndicate members. We can understand that in terms of what I call syndication principles. How can we explain the relationship between the banks that make up the syndicate? As I see it, I think there's five key ideas. Severality, proportionality, equality, democracy, limited delegation of function. And by complete coincidence, the limited delegation of function corresponds with the limited functions of the agent bank. The agent bank only carries out what the syndicate instructed to do. The syndicate will not want to surrender rights, discretionary decision-taking with regards to all sorts of important issues, interest, cancellation, extension of the term. All of these decisions will have to be taken by the syndicate directly, by each of the banks directly. Therefore, there's only limited administrative functions ultimately delegated to the agent bank. So we can actually see the relationship between the syndicate in terms of this limited delegation of function as corresponding with the actual scope of the duties and obligations of the agent bank. So there's five key ideas. Severality. All of the syndicate members are lending on a several, not joint and several basis. If one of the banks decides not to lend, not to make available its 10 million, do the other 9 banks have to lend? No, of course not, because it's several. What will happen in practice simply is that the lead bank, if this occurs, someone withdraws before the closing, before the signing, the lead bank will find another syndicate member. If this happens after the signing and the closing, the agent bank will try and find another member to bring in. But the banks don't have to cover make-up payments not made by another contributing member. It's several. The banks are liable proportionately. It doesn't have to be equal. What will happen is there'll be a schedule to the document which lists the banks. In that schedule, it will specify how much each of the banks is making available. And our example is equal. 100 million, 10 banks, $10 million each. In practice, it could be any proportion. It could be any sum. It could be a quarter, it could be a tenth, it could be a fifth, it could be a third, it could be anything. That will all be set out in the schedule. What will then happen is that bank will make available its proportionate amount. Equality. All of the banks are equal. These are some of the largest, most powerful, experienced institutions in the world. They're not dealing as agents on behalf of anybody else, on behalf of each other. They're dealing as principals, and they all have equal status in this. The lead bank, the agent bank, the lead bank and the agent bank do not have any additional discretionary rights of any form. All the decisions will be taken by the syndicate members, and they will be taken equally, with one vote per seat, basically. If there's any voting, which there usually won't be, certainly for important matters, if there's any voting, it will be on a supermajority basis, or a majority or supermajority, such as 66 2/3% rather than a simple 50%. But what will happen in practice is the syndicate banks don't want to surrender core decision-taking authority. As I've said already, if we're altering the interest rates, if we're extending the term, any other decision with regards to rescheduling will all be taken by each of the banks individually, together, as a group, one bank, one vote. Democracy, as we've just said, is all equal, it's all consensus, there's usually no majority power. If there is any decisions to be taken, very often they'll be on a supermajority basis. And then limited delegation of function. The banks want to take all the decisions themselves. Only the more administrative, basic, day-to-day, non-executive tasks will be transferred to the agent bank. If any crisis or any other decisions arise, there'll have to be meetings, and then, as we've said, this will be taken on an equal, open consensus basis. The duties of the agent bank, then, we can actually specify separately, so I can see at least five. Receipt duties, payment duties, banking duties, notification duties, and default duties. As we've said, what's going to happen is the lead bank, the managing bank, sets up the facility. Very often, the lead bank or managing bank will be a participant member, because that then attracts interest by other syndicate banks. If you're the lead bank, you want to say, I'm going to be a member, I will put up 10 million. That's the easiest way to get other banks to come in. It's harder if you're not a participant to try and get other banks to come in lend. So usually the lead bank or the managing bank will be a syndicate member. But very often they don't want to actually stay in the syndicate and then lend during the term of the funding, which might be 20 years. And what will actually happen in practice, the deals I used to do, the lead bank, it wants that large fee. It wants that 0.5% or 0.5% plus upfront fee charged on the 100 million. That's what it's looking for. Then it wants to go on to the next deal. So very often what will actually happen is the lead bank or the managing bank will actually sell its participation even before the closing. It's going to bring another bank in to provide its funding before the closing. We call that a participation or a sub-participation. So there's 10 banks, one of them is the lead bank. Lead bank's number one. But what it can actually do is this. It will actually bring another bank in to provide its funds, that 10 million, for the 20 years. Because it doesn't want to generate funds by actually charging the interest during the term. It doesn't want the margin. It wants the payment up front to then go on to the next deal, then the next deal, then the next deal. Because we can set these up in maybe 1 month, 2 months. I mean, we can roll these over. And if you're doing this type of work in a law firm, you may be rolling these over 1 month, 2 months, 3 months. Then you're on to the next deal, then the next deal, or you'll have them all overlapping anyway. So very often, the lead bank is actually going to bring another bank in, and it's going to disappear as of the signing day or the closing day. If it notifies the other banks, we just call that a participation. If it doesn't notify the other banks, we'll call that a blind participation. I've actually seen this. The lead bank, let's assume it's one of the large American banks, or Royal Bank of Scotland, or who do we say, Credit Suisse, Deutsche Bank, whatever. It actually, one of the deals I was doing, it brought in one of the Russian banks to actually provide the 10 billion, in the deal so that on the closing, the lead bank, managing bank, disappears. So all of these other duties which have to be administered for the following 10 or 20 years are all discharged by the agent bank. And then we can summarise these in terms of receipt, payment, banking, notification and default. Okay? Now, in terms of the advantages of syndication, I've summarised these below. Increased or improved credit risk, capital charge, large exposures, liquidity, funding, diversification, repudiation, business expansion, country expansion, improved terms, and fee income. And I've mentioned the fees there. 0.5% to the lead bank, 0.7% is the commitment fee, and then there'll be an administrative fee for the agent bank. In terms of the actual terms and conditions in the deal itself, the actual obligations, there's three key sets of provisions. I summarised those in the outline that I provided separately before. You've got three key sets of provisions we need to understand. Those are the conditions precedent, there are the representations and warranties, and there are the covenants. The conditions precedent are essentially to do with documentation provision. So it's constitutional documents for the borrowers. Each of them will have to provide articles and memorandum of association. Each of them will also have to provide resolutions. You need board resolutions confirming that the company has authority to enter into this specific deal. So we need to get board resolutions from each of the companies. What we also need to do is this. In practice, what will happen is each of the borrowers will guarantee each other. Now, that's actually contrary to company law. Because under company law, each company in a larger group has to still be considered as an independent company, not part of the group. And the director's duties are to the company and not to the group as a whole. So there's a fundamental conflict there. Because what's happening is each of the group will only be allowed to participate if it guarantees the obligations of each other member of the group. So what we actually have to do, and you will do this in practice, is collect board resolutions which specifically confirm that the directors have considered the potential liability of each company guaranteeing the liabilities of other members of the group, although the advantage of participating in this larger facility is that we can borrow this total larger amount and at cheaper commercial rates than would otherwise be available. So what you do is this. It's quite easy to come up with a legitimate commercial justification for participating in the facility, but you need to have that recorded in writing. You need a board resolution to specify that, because otherwise the duties of the directors of each company would be in breach of its immediate responsibility to that company. So you need to actually get board resolutions confirming the entering into of the loan agreement as well as the specific provision of group guarantees for other members of the facility. Okay? So we collect all of that as part of the constitutional documents. There may be separate sovereign confirmations if it's to do with a state that we're borrowing from, and if there's any need for any specific licenses, consents, or other approvals, for example, parliamentary approvals. If it's secured, most of the euro-dollar deals, the main large standard vanilla deals, are unsecured. But it might be secured for some specific purpose as part of some of these other facilities up there. There'll be a range of other confirmations we need with regards to the security, its location, the effectiveness of the charge, and whatever else has been taken out. We'll also need legal opinions. We'll take a legal opinion to ensure that this facility and the enforcement and recovery under the facility is enforceable in every necessary country. So, for example, each of the borrowers, you'll need a legal opinion from each of their jurisdictions so that we know that this is enforceable and that if necessary we can execute against their assets. So we'll take legal opinions from all of the jurisdictions which are concerned. In this area you will become experts at writing legal opinions, and we can come back and talk about that in further detail. Any other confirmations, any other conditions which are specified, including what we call conditions subsequent. The conditions precedent are to the facility, but there may be other conditions subsequent that we impose that we want afterwards. The representations and warranties are a series of other statements of confirmation and undertakings. A representation is a statement of fact rather than opinion or law. And a warranty is a promise or undertaking. So we're going to have representations and warranties. And these basically confirm a lot of the other matters already covered in the CPs, but we want them restated. Does the company have legal authority? Is it legally entitled to enter into this? Is this enforceable in the local jurisdiction? Have all necessary consents and other approvals been obtained? So there's a range of representations and warranties that we will take. The warranties will include providing regular financial information, regular reports, compliance with any financial covenants or ratios, obligations imposed. It's a combination of these. We're going to come back and look at this in further detail. The key point simply is this. The representations are less strong legally than the warranties. And the warranties are less strong than the covenants, which are actually conditions or obligations. And what we actually do in practice is this. We're trying to elevate the representations to warranties and the warranties to covenants or conditions. And the reason for this legally is that if you breach a representation, and even if you breach a warranty, you only get damages. But what do the banks want? The banks want rescission. They want to be able to rescind the deal. In practice, they won't rescind the deal, but the power to rescind the deal gives them a much more powerful negotiating position. Banks want the right to rescind because then they can renegotiate and they can exercise a lot of power and a lot of authority in the course of that renegotiation. The problem is just with a breach of warranty and with a breach of representation, you don't get rescission, you only get damages. So in practice, the language will be, we represent and warrant. So you're elevating the reps to the W's. But also what you'll then do is this, you're going to tie those into the defaults. So you'll say that breach of the reps and W's gives you a right to rescission, a full right to default. So we're elevating them again. So the reps go up to the W's and the W's go up to the conditions of the cuffs. And we'll come back and look at the case law in relation to that. And then you have the continuing covenants. The covenants are a series of obligations which apply on an ongoing basis that the borrowers are going to enter into to secure continued availability of the funds. These will include a series of specific obligations. There's corporate covenants, there's financial covenants, which are a series of ratios that we're going to have the borrower comply with. In practice, the way the banks exercise control is by imposing financial ratios. By just using 1-2 and more complex deals, 3-4-5 project finance deals, up to 10-12 financial ratios, you can exercise a massive amount of control over the borrower and the borrower's group. Because the borrower and the borrower's group cannot do anything that breaches those ratios. The problem is this, the banks don't want to become shadow directors. If they actually run the borrowers on a day-to-day basis, they can be liable for any misfeasance or misconduct or illegal conduct that they enter into. Banks don't want to become shadow directors, but they want maximum amount of control they can exercise. That's why we will draft the clauses in their favour. But the main way that the banks can control the activities of the borrowers is through the financial ratios. And we'll come on and look at all of those in further detail. So you've got the financial covenants, which impose the financial ratios. You've got other information covenants, reporting covenants, and then other general undertakings. On the corporate covenants, the main provisions are the negative pledge, the pari passu, the disposals, and we'll look at each of those. What we're then going to do is this. We've got the financials, we've got the obligations, and then we've got the default provisions. So we need to look at the defaults, and we need to make sure all of these tie together. So again, I've summarised the default clauses there. What will trigger a default? Non-payment, obviously. Either interest or repayment of principal. It's payment of interest during term and repayment of principal on maturity. That's the language. Breach of financial covenants. That's the ratios we've just mentioned. Any other non-financial breach. Any misrepresentation. And we'll look at all the different forms of misrepresentation, which I've summarised separately on the right. We can have fraudulent misrepresentation. We can have statutory misrepresentation. We can have negligent misrepresentation. There's about five different types of misrepresentation we have to be careful of. Where does this principally arise? Mainly in the information memorandum. And that's where, as a lawyer, you have to be very careful. The information memorandum will be prepared by the lead bank, the managing bank, with the borrower and the borrower's accountants. But what's going to happen is they will always exaggerate. Always. They will always overstate points. The borrower is in excellent financial condition. Its business projects could not be any higher, could not be any better. We expect to generate massive amounts of income. All of these types of statements. They will be all the way through the information memorandum, and you have to go through them with a red line, a red pen, and score them all out. If they cannot substantiate them. Because otherwise, that's a misrepresentation. And if that's a misrepresentation, someone's going to be held liable. And what you don't want is you don't want your client to get into difficulty, because if he or she gets into difficulty, you're in difficulty. So this is core basic commercial financial law. We need to make sure there's no misrepresentations, either innocent, negligent, statutory, or fraudulent. And I'll go through all of this. And you need to make sure no one makes any mistakes. In these deals, it's not like litigation. In litigation, lawyers are always trying to sort of argue something or hide something or do something which can catch the other side out. This isn't litigation. The point is, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work for anyone. And everyone makes mistakes. And this, you're trying to make sure everything works, all of the documentation comes together, everything's drafted perfectly, properly, and everybody gets what they're looking out of this. In practice, you'll be sitting in your office, you'll get a document coming in from Hong Kong, or Shanghai, or New York, from one of the largest law firms in New York, and it will be dreadful. It will be terrible. And what do? Do you leave all these mistakes? No, you fix them. But in practice, you fix them, and you let the partner or the senior partner know you fix them. But we need to make these deals work. But the big thing is liability. Your duty is to your client to make sure there's no unforeseen liability incurred. If the client wants to take risks, you can explain the risks to them. But you need to make sure that you identify all potential causes of liability and you cover your client. That is your role, that's your responsibility, that's your function. So we'll come back and look at this. So misrepresentation is absolutely crucial. There's then two key clauses. There's the cross default, and then bottom, slightly down right, the material adverse change. We've also got insolvency, creditor processes, control, illegality. These are all obvious standard clauses. The cross-default and the max, they're more difficult. The cross-default simply specifies that if the borrower or one of the borrower's group defaults on another facility, that can trigger a default on this facility. Now, that sounds very useful. It sounds like something we have to have in practice, but it's also very dangerous. The point simply is this. If you trigger a default under this facility, you know the borrower, which will be a government or one of the largest companies in the world, will have another 20, 100, 1,000 other facilities outstanding. If you trigger cross-default on this, you're triggering cross-default on everything else. And if you're triggering cross-default on everything, if you can't ensure a restructuring or a rescheduling, that's insolvency or collapse. And what are you going to get in the event of a collapse? Possibly zero. So you have to be very careful. The cross default, you don't want to leave it too late, but you don't want to be too early. Because if you trigger the cross default too fast, too quick, it's guaranteed insolvency. Certainly if it's a corporate. You can't make a government insolvent, but still you're in the same situation where it's a forced rescheduling or forced restructuring. You have to be very careful with these cross defaults. We want the power, we want the right, but it's just a question of when we exercise them. The other difficult clause is the MAC clause, material adverse change. The MACs, the bankers always want them very general, very wide, so that everything can be a MAC. The problem is if everything's a MAC, it's very easy to trigger default, which then triggers the cross default. So again, you have to be very careful with this. The borrowers want very narrow MACs, the bankers want very wide MACs, you have to find something in the middle. Because these are difficult clauses, well, specifically the MAC, the LME doesn't provide a MAC drafting. I'll show you some MACs, separate MACs, and you get big ones and you get short ones. It's difficult. These are the types of provisions you'll spend a lot of time negotiating. Cross default and the MAC clauses and the ratios. Very often the ratios are, it's almost the banks just decide. The ratios are usually determined by the accountants acting for the banks. And they'll say, these are the ratios, these are the rates that we want, and it's almost like there's no negotiation. The borrowers might try and negotiate, you will see. But this is the type of issue that what will happen is, in practice, you'll know to anticipate. A lot of this is standard, a lot of this is very straightforward, a lot of this, because you know the documents, you know what should be in the drafting and should be in the clauses, because of reasonable clauses, because you're looking at standard documentation, because you know what a standard document should look like, you'll be able to spot very quickly any variations, anything that's against your favour or in your favour. And that's just a skill that you'll develop over time. Just to finish this up, so we look at the defaults. If the borrower wants to if the borrowers can bring in additional borrowers, so there will be facilities for that inside the loan agreement, so we'll look at forms of accession. We can bring in other borrowers, and also the banks can transfer, banks can move their obligation, transfer the facility. There's different ways of doing that. Legally, historically, you couldn't transfer a personal loan. The banks couldn't transfer the loans. Now there's a series of devices that we can use for legally effective transfers. I've summarised them at the bottom. Assignment, novation, participation, risk participation, securitisation. We'll go back over each of those. I'll give you a separate summary of the nature of these. Assignment can be legal or equitable. You'll see there, conditions are set out in section 136 of the Law of Property Act 1925. Basically, it has to be in writing, has to be for a fixed, non-unconditional amount, and there has to be notice. In practice, what will happen is the banks don't want to give notice that they're transferring their obligations to the borrower, because they want the borrower to think the bank's always participating, it's always there, it's always available, to protect that relationship. So it becomes an equitable assignment rather than a legal assignment. An equitable assignment is legally as effective. The only problem is you can lose priorities, you can lose other rights of set off. In particular, if the loan is transferred to another party who gives notice to the borrower before you, you can lose priority that way. But because this is a closed deal, it's a closed set of relations, usually it's not a problem. The fact is that we can generally rely on equitable assignment rather than legal assignment in these deals in practice. So we'll come back and look at all of these in further detail. The final point is what we've already mentioned, loan restructuring or rescheduling. If it's a voluntary renegotiation, we can call that a rescheduling. If it's forced or compulsory because the borrower is in difficulty, we can call that a restructuring. In practice, what's going to happen is this. The banks don't want to surrender any terms, but what they will consider, especially dealing with sovereign borrowers, state borrowers, is reducing the interest, extending the term. The Greek debt crisis, that's what this was all about. The commercial banks were actually forced to write off quite a lot of the debt, but the sovereigns and the international financial institutions, including the International Monetary Fund and the European Central Bank, what did they do? They insisted on full repayment from Greece. But they said, oh, we'll make it easy for you. We'll reduce the interest and we'll extend the term. But we still want paid in full. There's various ways of doing this. There's what we call a Paris Club and a London Club, and we'll come back and look at each of those in further detail. These are just informal mechanisms that the banks can come together and try to negotiate either with the sovereigns or with the corporate entities some form of agreed repayment adjustment. Then there's also, for heavily indebted poor companies, HIPC, HIPICS, that the World Bank and the IMF, they can assist with them separately. And then there's various other facilities that the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank can enter into, and they can use in practice to try and secure some type of renegotiation. With all of that, we can understand the international syndicated loan market. We can see it all in one transaction. We can see it all in one deal, on one page. We can understand all of the parties, all of the core rights and obligations, and all of the key legal issues that we need to highlight and consider in our negotiation and preparing of the documentation to make sure that all of this works effectively.